So welcome to another talk, another day. Hopefully you're beginning to relax now and get used to the place, get some good rests, so that hopefully some of your tiredness, if not all of it, can be overcome by now, and you can start getting some more energy coming up. Now, you need that energy to be able to be mindful. One of the difficulties in meditation is when there is no mindfulness, you don't really know how to let go. In fact, you don't know what you're doing. It's like driving a car when you're drunk. So, you know, if you are, not that I would know that, of course, but some people tell me. So when you are meditating, sometimes, yeah, you got all the instructions, you know, just to let go, just to be peaceful, be kind, be gentle, but it doesn't work. Just like you may know how to drive a car, but you know, if you don't know where all the controls are, you don't know where the brake is, or you know, you're just half asleep, of course you will crash. So it's really important to have that energy so you really are mindful. This is one of the important teachings. It's not just about being mindful, it's just how mindful are you, and also where you put that mindfulness. That's really important. So first of all, like how you are mindful, you will notice throughout the day, maybe not at the time, but using your power of memory, a recollection, there are times of the day when your mind is very sharp and clear. And there are times we don't know really what you're doing. Maybe when you woke up in the morning, oh, where am I? You know, what's going on here? I remember one monk, years and years ago, he woke up in the morning, he meant actually to turn his alarm clock off. But instead, he put his hand on the toothpaste and got toothpaste all over his hand. It's actually much better than an alarm clock, because when you've got toothpaste all over your hand, you can't go back to sleep. But when you press the clock, you can. But he didn't know where he was or what he was doing, simply because often when you first wake up, your brain hasn't really turned on yet. Your mindfulness is at its lowest. And there are other times in the day, yeah, you think you're awake, but you're not really that awake. And you can tell that because you close your eyes and you meditate. You're not really there. It's not bright and it's not clear. And even other things, you may be walking down and trip over things, step on things or whatever. It means you're not really alert. So that's why it does take a while to bring up the mindfulness to a level where you can meditate. And if you haven't got enough mindfulness, basically you're driving a car with a foggy windscreen. You're driving a little bit drunk, your awareness is not strong enough, which is one of the reasons why people meditate, they don't get anywhere, or they get frustrated, they think they can't do it, because they haven't done the preparation to be mindful enough, first of all, so when they look at the mind, they can see what's going on, they can see where all the dials and all the knobs are. Then you can actually do some of your meditation. And that's one of the reasons why people say, well, look, we've been here an hour and a half. And no, not an hour and a half, a day and a half. And no, you haven't taught us how to meditate yet. And I won't until you're awake enough, alert enough, mindful enough, so that when I give the instructions, you know actually how to apply them. So the first thing to do in a meditation retreat is empower people with mental energy and clarity and happiness. Because they all go together enough. So that when you do sit down and watch your mind, you can actually see what you're doing. You know that it's really easy to meditate. So it's just establishing mindfulness, first of all, is one of the tasks. And that is why I ask you to rest a lot. Because when you're tired, with the best will in the world, you can't be that mindful. You know, you're a bit asleep. I just came back from a trip to UK and Norway. And it's wonderful, when you come back, you've got an excuse for making mistakes. You know, jet lag, I'm tired. Unfortunately, I've run out of that excuse anymore. Now I've been back 2 weeks, so I can't have any more excuses. But, and it's true, if you're tired, if you're sick, you're going to lose a lot of mindfulness. And it's very difficult to know what you're doing. So first of all, rest. Eat well. Not too much, though, because then you lose your mindfulness again. Just enough. And get a little bit of happiness in your life. It's that happiness is very, very important to be able to have strong mindfulness. I've noticed that the miserable people in this world have got very little mindfulness at all. But those ones who are joyful, who are happy, they're the ones who have some mindfulness, because they've got energized minds. Which is one of the reasons, you know, just this morning, those of you who were here this morning, again, to do the three over-the-top sadhus, you know, you can see what's happening there. That gives you energy, it makes you laugh, and it brings happiness to your life. So part of actually developing mindfulness is being a little bit playful. Playfulness is an incredibly powerful tool, which, because of our stupid culture, we think, oh, I'm too old to be playful now. You're never too old to be playful. Playful, I was taught this when I was in doing research in physics. It's the people who are playful, who mess around with things, who make the great discoveries. In the same, when you're very playful, you get great insights. When you're playful, you can find, you can discover different ways of doing things. Playfulness is another way of thinking outside the box, so that you can actually meditate better, sit better. So be playful. Why do you always sit in the same position? You know, the next meditation, sit back to front, facing that way. Just be playful. Turn your chair upside down. I don't care what you do. But do it slightly differently, and straight away you'll realize you have a little bit more mindfulness. For example, when you get up in the morning and you go to the toilets, do you brush your teeth early in the morning? When you brush your teeth, on which side of the mouth do you start? Top, bottom, left or right, or in the middle? Whichever way it is, the next time you brush your teeth, start somewhere else. Live on the wild side. Because you see what happens, if you always do it the same place, the top left, say, you start there, it becomes habit. And when it's habit, there's no mindfulness, no awareness at all. If you do things differently, it takes a little bit of effort. And because you're doing it different, your mind is more awake, more alert, more mindful. That's why doing things slightly differently makes life a bit more interesting. When you have your lunch later on, how do you usually have your lunch? Do you usually have like the rice and the curry first and then the sweets? Try the other way around. Have the sweets first and then the rice and curry. Slightly different, just to be a bit playful. One of the great monks in Thailand years ago, I went to go and see him. He was amazing, like Ajahn Sing Tong. No, Suwadi, you may, where is she? Yeah, there you are. Remember Ajahn Sing Tong? And he was, you know, one of the great monks. Unfortunately, he died in this plane crash with a lot of other senior monks. But, you know, he was one of the star monks, great meditator, great teacher. But he was outrageous. I was talking about him a couple of days ago with the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery. Now, this was the Thai forest tradition. Very strict, very restrained. When he would give the blessing, I'm going to imitate the blessing he gave. When I first went there, he did this every day. Those of you who've been to Bodhinyana Monastery, or the Nuns Monastery, you'd probably do the same sort of blessings. He started off, I'm just imitating now, he went, Yata Wari Waha Pura Pari Purenti Sagarang Ewa Mewa Ito Dinang Petanang Upaka Pati Ichitang Patitang Tumhang Kipa Mewa Samicha. And that is accurately how he did it. He had me, you know, bursting out laughing at everybody else. You went to see that monk and everybody was happy, alert, interested. He was a brilliant teacher. He put energy and was playful, and he was just incredibly popular. But not just, you know, like being an entertainer. He was very, very wise as well. And so that sort of thing, which you put some playfulness, you know, into your life, into your meditation, straight away it gives you energy. Depression will never come into your life. It makes, you know, your life interesting. You're interesting to other people as well. And also your meditation really gets going because you've got energy. It's putting energy into that life. And that means your mindfulness goes up so you can actually see more and hear more. When you're doing walking meditation, I've already mentioned a few types of walking meditation. You can do, you're in Australia now, many of you. You try to do the kangaroo walking. Just put your hands like this and hop and hop and hop. But do it mindfully. So you hop and hop and hop. Try that. It's not a joke, because it actually works. You'll find you actually wake up. And you also wake the other people up as well, because they see you and they burst out laughing as well. What is this crazy meditator up to? But it works. So you see, you've learned another form of walking meditation. The kangaroo hop mindful walk. So what that does, if you understand the reason why I ask you to brush your teeth at a different part of the mouth, you understand one of the enemies of mindfulness is habit. Always doing things the same old way, every time. You know what happens? If you do the same old thing every time, your mind goes to sleep. It's an automatic pilot. In the same way, if you drive to work every day, a lot of times it's just automatic. You don't notice anything. It means you're thinking about something else, listening to the music on the radio or whatever. You're not really there. You've done it so many times, it's automatic, so what? Which is why it's nice to go a different way to work every morning. You know, just do something different to make that mindfulness stronger. So on this retreat, please be careful of getting into the rut of habit. Always getting up at the same time, always going to bed at the same time, always eating the same food, if there is any that is at lunchtime. Always sitting in the same place, doing things the same way. No wonder you lose your strength of mindfulness. So a bit of fun, change your routine, do things slightly differently. It takes a little bit more effort, yeah, but it wakes you up. And you know when you wake up, when you get energy, you do feel happier. The two things always go together. So, you know, that playfulness is mindfulness plus happiness all coming together. And when you do that, your mindfulness increases. And when it gets to a certain level, it becomes an automatic that you get a lot of peace, you got a lot of happiness, you got a lot of energy. It's just getting to that tipping point where the mindfulness really starts to take off. And it's strong enough because then you can watch the mind. It's so easy. There's no problems at all in the meditation. You're not restless. You're not tired. Everything goes really, really well. So we have to somehow arouse that mindfulness. Which is why if you do get a little bit sleepy, the first couple of days, the best thing to do for your mindfulness when you're sleepy is go to bed. I know there's other ways of dealing with it. When I first went to Thailand, it was just before the end of the Vietnam War, you know, when Saigon, Phnom Penh, and what's the other place, Vientiane, all fell within days of each other. So we still had, you know, the Laotian monks coming over, and these were the old meditation monks from Laos. And there was one I always remember. He was the abbot of this monastery just somewhere in the forests of Laos. And he was a great, renowned meditation teacher, because what he would do to make sure his monks really stayed mindful was he would take them on a walk through the jungle all day. Now, the jungles in, you know, Southeast Asia, they're not like the forests over here. They're thick with trees, with mosquitoes, with all sorts of other bugs, just like in Sri Lanka. And it's so hot, you sweat, and it's dirty, and you get really tired. So by the end of the day, going this long walk through the jungle, the monks were exhausted. And they'd always find, just maybe late in the afternoon, maybe 4 or 5 o'clock, he'd always arrange to come to this special clearing in the jungle. Well, there's magnificent trees, and I don't know, 80-foot, 100-foot high trees, beautiful trees in this virgin forest. And on the big branches of the trees, the monks had built platforms, just the size of your seat here, no bigger than that, and with a bamboo ladder to climb up. And all the monks who'd just been on a walk had to climb up the bamboo ladder and sit on the little platform. There was no railings around. Occupational health and safety never made it to Laos. And then the abbot would take the ladder away and say, "I'll be back in the morning." And there you were, 100 feet above the ground, just with this size of mat to sit on. You couldn't lay down. And even you start nodding, if you fell off, that would be it. You'd be dead. Many monks got great meditation up there facing death. The others we never heard about. They're all dead. That's the trouble, because in our tradition, they all used to say about these things, the monks would sit next to the cliff, the monks who went to the tiger caves. Yeah, we all know about the monks who survived. We were never told about the monks who got eaten by the tigers. That story never came down the lineage. But that, yeah, okay, you can use fear, but no, that's really a terrible way to overcome sort of sleepiness and to rouse your mindfulness. Yes, fear will make you mindful. If I told you that in Australia we've got the most dangerous snakes in the world, and there's many snakes in this temple here, and if I release one in this room, none of you will be sleepy. Those of you who didn't run out, that is. Fear, you could use fear, but I mean, fear is just a very negative emotion to make, and it just makes you more tight, more controlled. Yes, you're aware, but it's not a very useful type of awareness. It's awareness which comes with force and with a lot of suffering attached to it. It's the same with, you know, that your personal effort, come on, be mindful, and really screwing up your energy and trying to make mindfulness out of willpower. That too doesn't really work, because after a while you run out of willpower. It just takes too much energy to maintain just through sheer willpower. That's why using willpower also does not work. I remember this monk, I have his bowl. When he disrobed, he gave me his bowl, and I still have it to this day. And he was a French monk, and he was very quiet. And every time we meditated, he always sat dead straight. Never once did we see him nod, not even slightly. Even during the nights we would meditate throughout the night without any sleep, he'd always be perfectly straight. And amongst ourselves, you know, the monks talking to each other, we always thought, wow, that really is a great monk. What amazing meditator, so quiet, so peaceful, never sleepy. He must be that close to being fully enlightened if he's not already. And then to all of our surprise, he disrobed. And it was a shock to me. What's happening? And we found out afterwards when he told us, he said, it was just so much suffering, you know, having to hold my body straight like that through willpower, because I was so afraid, you know, of doing something wrong and being criticized. So much afraid of my peers looking down upon me because I nodded. And he used 4 years of sheer willpower to keep his body straight, and after that he couldn't stand it any longer. He was a control freak, and that really saddened me. If only I had known. He said that sometimes during those all-night sits he would open his eyes and he'd see me down here somewhere. And he said, you wouldn't believe how jealous I was of you. If only I could do that. But he couldn't. And that's one of the problems there. Using willpower, being a control freak, just, yes, you can be mindful, but it's not the type of mindfulness which will lead to any happiness or deep stillness or insight. It's just, again, doing more of the same. Playfulness, joy, wisdom, power, that creates great mindfulness. And that's the beautiful type of mindfulness which you could really use, which does lead to a lot of depth in meditation, peace and happiness. So we can try and develop the peaceful mindfulness. And how can you actually use the wisdom power, the joy and the wisdom power, to develop the happiness? Again, one way of doing that, look after your body. The first thing the Buddha did when he realized that getting deep meditation, the jhanas, was a way to enlightenment, The first thing he did, he said, look, with my body like this, tired, you know, malnourished, and just, you know, too weak, you can't get deep meditation like that. He at least was wise enough to make sure he looked after his body. So he looked after his body, you know, ate well. In fact, you know, the day before he became enlightened, you know, he had this food which was actually prepared for a deva, for a celestial being. Just like the food we eat here. Celestial food. So that's why we make sure you eat well. Because it worked for the Buddha, maybe it worked for you. So you have a good meal, you rest, you bathe. And then when he meditated, he got this very soft cushion. You know, he's supposed to have meditated at the root of the Bodhi tree. Now, if you've ever seen a Bodhi tree, actually we have one just in the secret garden over there, if anyone's found it yet. There's a Bodhi tree over there, but it's only a small sapling. If you see a really big Bodhi tree, these fig trees, their roots are just so knobbly. It must be torture to sit on one of the knobbly roots of a Bodhi tree. So, of course, the Buddha never just sat on the roots. He got a big pad of grass, this huge saffu to sit on, to make sure he was comfortable. So with that peace, his mindfulness could not be just generated through fear, through discomfort, through pain, or through whatever, things like that. It was just through the beautiful wisdom power of kindness. Kindness develops mindfulness. If you're kind to your body and you're kind to your mind, then your mind engages. One of the obstacles to mindfulness, I've already mentioned sleepiness, is restlessness. Why does your mind always run away? Why can't it stay still? Why, you know, you start meditating, you start thinking of all sorts of other things. And years ago, I developed the following simile, because I was watching, why does my mind keep running away? Instead of trying to stop it through willpower, I try to understand it. Why? And I soon figured out that my mind kept on wandering off because it didn't like me. Have you ever tried to make friends with someone? As soon as you call them up, they say, no, sorry, I'm busy. Would you like to come around and say, oh, no, I'm not free today? It's like telling you something. They don't like you. So any time I tried to hang out with my mind, it ran away. And so I developed the simile of the coffee shop. Imagine that one day you ring up, you ring up your friend and say, look, I've got an afternoon off. I know you're not working this afternoon. Come out for a cup of coffee. And we won't go to Starbucks. We won't go to Dome. We go to Gloria Jean's. And we won't have a flat white or a capo. You'll have a latte, because that's what I like. And not with milk, with soy milk, because that's what I want. You won't have any sugar, because that's bad for you. And we'll have just a biscuit, but not a muffin. And I want you to sit on my table, which is in the corner, not on the veranda, because that's too public. I don't like being out there. I like being in the corner. And we want to talk about, you know, Buddhism. I know you're a Catholic. I don't want to talk about Christianity. I just want to talk about Buddhism, and especially about meditation, because that's what I'm really interested in. And look, I've only got, you know, an hour and a half, and I want to spend that hour and a half. So if you want to leave early, that's not on. Stay 1 hour and a half, but no more than that, because I've got an appointment afterwards. Now, if you told somebody like that, what would they say? They'd say, I'm a bit busy today. I can't quite make it. Try again tomorrow. Now you understand why your mind runs away, because that's what you do to it. Come on, we're going to watch the breath. Not the body contemplation, not vipassana. We're going to do samadhi, Ajahn Brahm's retreat. Okay, now you've got to do this. And you've got to do it for 1 hour, because 30 minutes is not enough. An hour and a half is too long, because I've got to go to do something afterwards. I've got an interview. I'll put my name down. So an hour and a half, okay. Now, I know you like to go off all over the place, but this time I want you to stay still. I want you to do it my way, okay? Not the way you want to do it. And you're going to sit in this position, not that position. Now you understand why, as soon as you close your eyes and watch your mind thinks, my God, she's watching me, and runs away. I can't stand you. That's why kindness works. Now imagine, you ring up your friend. Oh no, let's say, change it around. She rings you up and say, hey, now I'm free this afternoon. Are you free? Well, why? Well, look, I found this really nice coffee shop. But you know, you don't have to go there. Maybe that coffee shop you took me to last time, that's really, really nice. And you know, shall we go there? And you know, that coffee you gave me last time, you recommended, let's have some of that again. And yeah, you know, I'm really interested, you know, in hearing what you think about spirituality. You know, let's talk about Catholicism, because you know, that's really up your street and you really like that. And if you do things like that, then the person says, oh yeah, I'll come along. If you're kind to other people, then they like to hang out with you. You give them a call and they want to spend time with you. Why? Because they've been kind and you've been kind. So you can understand, if you want to maintain mindfulness on an object, you have to look after your relationship to that object. Are you the control freak? Are you the master and your breath, say, is your slave? Are you a perpetrator of mental abuse? Like, you've got pet abuse, you've got child abuse, and you've got brain abuse. Most people are brain abusers. They should go to jail for what they do to their brains. Always forcing it and telling it what to do. So, don't abuse your brain, your mind, or your body. Be kind to it. It's amazing, if you're kind to it, it will cooperate. That's why, earlier on, I asked you, when you first get up in the morning, ask your mind, what do you want to do today? Ask your brain, your body, what do you want to do? It's just general kindness. If you have a friend, you want to spend time with them, you don't just say, we're going to go here, we're going to go there. What do you want to do? And if you say that, say to your partner in life, say that to your friends, of course, they like hanging out with you. You're kind to them. You're sensitive. So often I ask my mind, sit down here, okay, here we are again, what do you want to do? You know, I've been so kind to my mind, as soon as my mind said to me, hey, it's you again, Ajahn. Ah, great to see you. Where have you been? And then we hang out together. And because I hang out with my mind, that's called mindfulness, no restlessness. We like each other. You know, I've had such good time with my mind over the years. So it's like meeting this dear old friend. We've had such wonderful occasions, wonderful times, a lot of laughs, a lot of happiness, a lot of profound experiences. So you become inseparable from your mind, which means no more restlessness, no more escaping into sleepiness. Can you see how kindness, a little bit of compassion, leads to mindfulness? The restlessness, the sleepiness vanish. So when you do come into this present moment, be kind to her, whatever this moment is. Respect her. And if you're kind to this moment, what you're doing, like in that book which I wrote, you're saying to this moment, right now, the fly, the heat, the ache, or the peace, whatever you're experiencing, the door of my heart is open to you. Moment. But no matter what you are, no matter how you are, I totally open the door of my heart to this moment. It gives rise to mindfulness, to peace. You have this beautiful awareness, not through force, but through the wisdom of compassion. And you can do that throughout the day, because what you're doing here is the mindfulness is not just on the object. I'm going to be watching the breath now. Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. Yeah, you're aware of the breath, but you can't do that for very long. I'm going to be aware of the body. I'm going to do walking meditation and become like this big control freak. You're missing the most important place where you should put your mindfulness. And that is between you and the object. It's not just me watching the breath. It's not being aware of me. It's not being aware of the breath, say. It's being aware of what's between those two. It's how are you aware of the breath? How are you aware of the walking? How are you aware of just the eating? What's between you and that food? If it is craving, the food goes into your mouth too quickly. So what I love doing is actually putting a lot of attention in the space between me and whatever I'm aware of, between the observer and the observed, and making sure that in that space, whether I'm watching the breath, or whether I'm watching my sleepiness, whether I'm watching a pain in the body, making sure that between me and that object are wholesome qualities, things like kindness, things like gentleness, things like peace, things like patience. So always remember, it's not whether I'm watching the breath or not, it's how I'm watching the breath. Am I watching the breath like a master to the slave? Or am I watching the breath like two friends hanging out together, two equals? Am I watching my sleepiness with shame and fear? I'm a monk, I'm supposed to be a meditation teacher, I'm fast asleep. It doesn't really matter what's happening. What's really important is how you are aware of that. What's between you and that object? That's where the defilements of Buddhism, the hindrances, the obstacles live. So when you put your mindfulness there, you make sure that this moment, whatever you're aware of it with these beautiful qualities of things like peace, kindness, letting go, gentleness, patience. As long as I'm aware that I'm being kind, I'm being peaceful, I'm not fighting things, I'm not being violent to my body or my mind, I'm patient. As long as I see these beautiful qualities between me and my mental object, I know that I'm making what's called good meditation karma. As I said yesterday, your future is being made right now. So my future success in meditation is being made right there in the space between me and my mental object. That's where my future meditation is going to succeed or fall apart. And if I put this beautiful peace between me and the object, beautiful kindness, compassion, gentleness, patience, then I know from experience and also through faith in the law of karma, the meditation will take off, become very, very peaceful. So the mindfulness is not just, say, of the breath or the body. It's the mindfulness of how you are watching. What's between you and the object? Are you like that person who rings up the friend and tells them what coffee shop they're going to go to? Or are you kind, compassionate, sensitive? If you put your attention there, again, the mindfulness is put in the right place, and you find the meditation becomes very, very easy. Remember what I said again in one of the first evenings, the two types of meditation? Very powerful teaching. I think I said it here, didn't I? And sometimes I'm playful. And so that's what I think it was a couple of people who came to monastery, and they were asking about meditation. And when I said there are two types of meditation, sometimes I like a bit of fun and games also. I ask people, what's the answer? What are the two types of meditation? And I know that most Buddhists say, Samatha Vipassana. It's some perverse part of my character. I enjoy tricking people and getting to say, no, that's the wrong answer. There's a certain amount of fun about that. I don't know why. Maybe I'm weird, but I enjoy it anyway. But the main point is that you realize that that's not the answer I was looking for. The answer I was looking for is that second noble truth meditation, the third noble truth meditation. What you're doing here, the second noble truth meditation, is where you put desire between you and your object. Desire is a cause of suffering. So if you are watching your body or watching your breath or whatever else you're doing in this meditation, if you're in the present moment or you're trying to be silent and there's desire between you and that silence, I want to be silent, I want to be silent, I want to be silent, it's bad meditation karma. It's second noble truth meditation. You're going to lead to suffering. You'll find no peace or happiness or freedom at all. But if you're watching the sleepiness, say, you're half asleep, but you can see enough there between you and that object, no desire. Yeah, I'm sleepy, so what, let it be. Stop fighting. I'm restless. Oh, okay. I'll let the mind be restless. That's what it wants to do. Fine.
then you'll find, because you're being kind, you're making good meditation karma, soon you become peaceful. It's like the third noble truth meditation. No desire leads to peace. I know people have used that many, many times in this world. There was a classic story of, I don't know actually what happened to her. She was a counselor at the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore some years ago. And I think they gave her a scholarship to study psychology, to become accredited as a counselor. And then she came back to work at the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore for a while. And she came here for a couple of weeks retreat. And you know, being sort of an academic, really a bright young lady, she was so restless. And you know, she couldn't stop thinking. That was her big problem. So I told her this story. And as I told the story, I would always remember this, because she was a respectful young lady, except when I started telling this story. And then she was holding her stomach, literally rolling on the floor, laughing her head off. And the reason was this, because the story I told was of a disciple over here in Perth, a very, very wise woman. And this woman, she said she had a kid, you know, a boy. He was about 6 years of age. And the boy sort of got very upset at his mummy one day. Now, I don't know what he was doing, but being naughty like kids are. And the mummy sort of, you know, tried to discipline the kid. And the kid said, "Right, that's it. Mummy, I don't love you anymore. I'm leaving home." Now, this was an incredibly smart mother, because the mother said, "Okay, darling, I'll help you pack." I know that many of you mothers might have thought of doing that many times, but she actually did it. So together they went into the kid's bedroom, and they packed all the essentials of life, like the teddy bear, like into this little six-year-old's bag. And then the mother said, "Oh, before you go, darling, I'll make you a sandwich for lunch." So made the favorite sandwich of the kid and put it in a little brown paper bag. And then they took them to the door of the house, and the mother waved her kid off and said, "Bye-bye, son, have a wonderful life." And there, with the little suitcase with a teddy bear in one hand and the lunch in the other hand, the kid walked to the end of the garden path and opened the gate and then went down the road. And the mother just standing at the house door. He was only 6 years of age when he first left home. I know he got as far as the corner of the street before the homesickness was too much to bear. And he turned around, went through the garden gate, down the path, and his mother was still standing there, waiting to greet him. "Welcome home, darling." Now that was actually brilliant psychology. And the reason this Singapore girl was laughing her head off, she said, "You wouldn't believe this, Ajahn Brahm. I did exactly the same." Well, similar, because you know, she was in one of these HBD blocks. You know, this is the big apartment blocks. So that when she wanted to leave home, yes, her mother helped pack the bags. That was exactly the same, but her mother never made her any sandwiches. Her mother gave her $20, buy your own lunch. Because that's Singapore. And she didn't go down the garden path. No, she went to the elevator, and the mother was there at the elevator, waved her off. "No, bye-bye, darling, have a wonderful life." And so she, the elevator doors closed. She pressed a button for the ground floor, and she said, "By the time I got to the ground floor, I missed my mum so much." So I pressed the button for the floor which I lived. I went straight back up, and as soon as the doors opened, the mother was waiting there. "Welcome home, darling." Because a mother knows the kid won't go too far. You know, just go down the end of the road, you know, just go to the bottom floor, and then we'll come back up again. You don't need to chase it. You don't need to force it. Just let it go, and it'll come back. And that's how you deal with your mind. With kindness. If your mind wants to wander off, okay, bye-bye. Now help pack the mind's bags. Give it $20 for his lunch. And off you go, bye-bye. Have a nice time wherever you want to wander to. And if you're very kind to it, again, it will come back again, almost immediately. It's very brilliant. Now, my classic story of that was, I had 5 reigns as a monk. And, no, 6 reigns. Because after five reigns as a monk, 5 years as a monk, in our tradition, we were allowed to go wandering. So off I went wandering, and when it came to the time of the rains retreat, I was looking for this, you know, the perfect monastery to spend the rains, and I found the perfect monastery for me. And I couldn't believe it. Now, I was an English monk. It was in the middle of a tea plantation. Forget about Bodhi trees. I like sitting at the foot of a tea. No, it was actually the monastery was just to the side of the tea plantation. But it was an abandoned monastery way up in the mountains, a deep cave, and I love that cave. Had some great meditation in there. And a really nice food up in the north of Thailand, much better than northeast Thai food. And the best part about it, the villagers, all they were interested in doing was feeding me. That was all. They didn't want me to teach them any Dhamma or meditation. So, you know, it was a perfect monastery. I left alone all day, except for when they fed me. And all, it was a perfect situation. It was in a valley. So actually, to go to the village, I had to, you know, just walk over the hill, maybe half an hour's walk. And then you saw the little houses where they would be more than happy to feed me. And I gave them a blessing. And when I got over the hill, I was by myself for the rest of the day. Perfect solitude. But actually, now once a week, there was a traffic problem. Once a week, you see the car. And if you were looking in the right direction, that was it. One car a week. That's all the traffic there was. And they would come up the mountain, bring up the posts and anything else they wanted, and take some of the produce, like the somos, like the grapefruit and other stuff which was growing up there. It was actually so quiet and so beautiful and peaceful. The most perfect place you could meditate, and by myself, no other monks were there, had the place to myself. And after about first couple of weeks were great meditation, and then it started to fall apart. I started getting restless, and I never had anyone to talk to. That was a problem. They would give me good advice. And so I started getting so restless. You know, there was only one, I remember this, the previous monk who was there was an ex-medical student. So the only book in English which was there was a medical directory, you know, of the different types of medicines. And I found myself one afternoon reading the medical directory because I was so bored, the only thing in English which you could read. I realized I was getting in trouble. But worse than that, you know, when I started meditating, I started getting so restless. And what really worried me was the type of thoughts going through my mind. They were what we call un-monkish thoughts. And thoughts of the old girlfriends he used to go out with. And thoughts of sex, romance, all that sort of stuff. Now, I always have been a very committed monk. I love being a monk. And so I didn't want any of those thoughts in my mind. I tried to chase them out. But you know, they kept coming in. And I had a lot of willpower. You know, I'd sort of be closing my eyes and be watching every breath. You know, just very with immense willpower. But all these thoughts, they just break down my defenses and keep coming in. It was so frustrating, you know, all day that was happening. And you get exhausted after a while trying to fight your mind and really ashamed of all these thoughts coming up, unmonkish thoughts. And after a while I got so frustrated, I decided to, you know, even I was a scientist before, I went to the main hall where there was a big Buddha statue and decided to do some really heavy duty praying. Help! And the thought came into my mind, and the thought was, let's make a deal. Because that's what Westerners do, we make deals. And the deal was this, I made this pact in front of the Buddha with my mind. For 23 hours of the day, you know, that's not including sleep, oh, it says including sleep time, for most of the day, mind, you will behave. You know, you watch the breath, you meditate. But for 1 hour every afternoon, from 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock, I give you permission to think any type of thought you want. Sex, weird sex, crazy sex, porn, whatever you want to think. Okay, I give in. 3 till 4, you can do whatever you want. But the rest of the day, behave. Now that really seemed fair enough. Okay, you just want to play time, off you go, do it, and I won't stop you. I won't inhibit you at all, I promise, as long as you behave the rest of the day. And I thought that made sense to me. That's, and I thought it would work. Of course it didn't, at least not the way I thought it would work. Because the rest of the day, I was still a struggle. And you try and watch the breath, and these thoughts will still come crashing in. And you can't stop them. You know, I'm sure you've experienced that. You know what it's like. The thoughts come in. They just keep coming in. You can't prevent them. And by the time it got to 3 o'clock, you know, I was so exhausted. I went up to my room, leant against the wall, put my feet out, because I was just tired. So I said, okay, mind, whatever you want to do. You can think the weirdest stuff. I'm not going to stop you. And for the next hour, this is no exaggeration, my mind watched every breath without missing one. The most peaceful hour of the whole day. And that was really weird. Why was it that when I was fighting my mind, all these thoughts would come in? But as soon as I said, okay, whatever you want to do, you can do it, then it was peaceful. It taught me why the mind is restless. I was fighting it so much that I was feeding its negative energy. So much so that it was getting more and more restless. And I was not being kind to it at all. As soon as I was being kind to my mind, okay, mind, whatever you want to think about, that's okay with me. Then it behaved. I had a beautiful meditation after that. It really taught me about where willpower fails. You're trying to control things. You find you get far more with kindness, where your mind wants to behave, because it likes you. So that's actually how the mindfulness works. And it's one of the reasons why I became a Buddhist. Because, you know, people were telling me the Buddha was a compassionate one, who was kind, was always forgiving. You read about his story, and people actually came to kill him sometimes. He would get angry at them. Had this story of all these assassins came to kill the Buddha. And as soon as they saw the Buddha, he was just too soft to kill. So they said, I'm sorry, I came here to kill you. What did the Buddha do? You came to kill me, I'm calling the police. You're going to get arrested. Of course not. But he said, ah, never mind. And he taught them a bit of Dhamma. They all became stream winners. But it was just so compassionate. Even people trying to kill him, he forgave straight away. So I always remember that type of compassion. I always like to meditate as if I was a Buddha. And I can just imagine what it's like to be a Buddha. As much as you can, and you meditate with a Buddha's mind. It's so kind to your defilements. So if you're sleepy, ah, never mind, you can go to sleep, come on. Go to sleep. You're restless, you want to think about stupid thoughts, oh, that's okay. Think stupid thoughts. You know, you're getting really upset at that person in the room who keeps banging their door. I want to kill them. That's okay. You can kill the person. Be kind. And then you find you can't kill anybody. So that's actually how you develop that mindfulness and how you put it in the right place. So just to sum up, you know, what I've said so far today, many sort of, you it's a waste of time even trying to meditate when the mindfulness is not strong enough. Rest. Just get into it. Just resting, being in the present moment, being silent. The mindfulness increases. You become more aware of, you know, feelings in the body, more aware of the sounds around you, more aware of your physical body, more aware of your mind. Aware enough that actually you can start to meditate properly without getting lost. And also put the mindfulness in the correct place between you and the object. And make sure between you and the object, there's not control here, not the master-slave like the coffee shop simile, but a lot of softness, a lot of gentleness, kindness and patience. Qualities which you all know are very positive and wholesome. And that's where you get great meditation by the end of the retreat. So that's how the mindfulness works.